suited to playing left field, but forced by a bad hamstring to try first base, is the unlikely chairman of the English department at West Central Pennsylvania University. Over the course of a single convoluted week, he threatens to execute a goose, has his nose slashed by a feminist poet, discovers that his secretary writes better fiction than he does, suspects his wife of having an affair with his dean, and finally confronts his philandering elderly father, the one-time king of American literary theory, at an abandoned amusement park. That is one hell of a week. Richard Russo is our guest. Do join us with your questions and comments as we talk. Here are the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside Champaign, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-9455 and 333-9455. Richard Russo, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing very well today. Thank you.
Good. So what else would you like listeners to know about Hank Devereaux?
This novel, I suspect that one of the reasons you're interested in talking with me is that this is an academic novel, but actually the academics of the novel, I think, are the surface of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And what this book is really more about is that curious stage of life that we call middle age, and the journey that we all make from left field when we were fleet of foot to a more stationary and perhaps less dangerous position in life at first base. That position where we tend to go when we've lost a step.
Mm-hmm.
And academics is kind of an interesting metaphor for that stage in life, because I think a lot of people, by the time they get to be Hank's age, he's closing in very rapidly on 50 years old, have become in one fashion or other kind of tenured, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've bought the house
mm-hmm.
that they wanted to buy, and their kids are grown up and have their own lives to mess up now, and you've probably become successful enough so that you're not hireable anyplace else, so you're kind of stuck where you are, and you're beginning to sense, as Hank does, that he's playing out, he's kind of playing out a string here. He's the story of his life, and he is a novelist and tends to think of things in narrative, in kind of narrative structure and line. He's beginning to think that his story is written, and now really what he's doing is just kind of rounding out an inevitable plot, which he, of course, as we all do, he deeply resents.
Hmm. The idea of tenure in the story is really a nice one, and that idea that in middle age we're looking at the tenure that we have, but this tenure is not a protection from persecution for great and challenging ideas. It's a protection from having to take chances to some extent.
Right.
It can be really numbing rather than freeing. What do you think of tenure in the academic world?
Well, I've come to think of it over the years probably as a kind of necessary evil that people
mm-hmm.
don't recognize the dangers in.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody recognizes the necessity of it, and I think that they recognize what can happen in academic institutions when there is no protection for professors, especially professors who have, it doesn't have to be in any particular field, in any field where you have ideas that are out of the mainstream and are considered either dangerous to other people or upsetting in some fashion or other. If there isn't some sort of protection for unpopular ideas, then people with unpopular ideas are going to get fired.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side of that coin, and the much more pervasive and much more dangerous, I think, side to tenure, is the fact that when you think about it, there aren't there aren't as many unusual and dangerous ideas around as there are kind of staid and stodgy notions that if they ever become protected and the people who have them ever become kind of protected, that they're doing themselves damage, that people who are protected by an institution, once the risk is gone, a lot of the fun of living is gone, and a lot of the incentive to new ideas is gone, and that side of tenure, which if you say what have you seen do more damage to people? Mm-hmm. I've seen far more colleagues and friends ruined by tenure than I've ever seen who were outlawed or made pariahs of as a result of holding unpopular ideas.
Mm. Unlike Hank Devereaux, who looks at his life and says, "We've all been here too long."
Mm-hmm.
You taught at several colleges.
Yeah, I was never anywhere too long. That's true.
And that's kind of interesting because that Hank's father, who is this noted academic, he moved around a lot too.
Yeah, yeah. My early career as a professor was, as you know, the case with especially a lot of writers in the academy as opposed to scholars.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's true of scholars too. But my own travels, especially in early career, was my travels were the result of trying to find a balance in the academy of my life as a writer and my life as a teacher. Anybody who teaches and does it well knows what a black hole it can be, and most writers in the academy are trying to find a way that they can balance their teaching life and the needs of their students with their own needs as artists, and it's a very difficult balance to achieve. And most writers are looking for a little bit less teaching and a little bit more time to write. And in my early career, a lot of my early moves were dictated by at least the promise of being able to strike a balance that would help me a little bit more as an artist. I started out teaching in institutions that pretty much required me to teach four sections of something or other a semester, very often three of them freshman comp. So eight courses a year, bringing home 100 or so essays every weekend doesn't leave a lot of time, especially for a novelist and a writer of big books too, because my books tend to sprawl a bit. I enjoy the wide canvas, and that particular kind of writer writing under the circumstances that require 40 or 45 or 50 hours a week of teaching and paper grading.
Yeah.
You know, you do that for a while and you begin to look for any job that comes along that offers you a little bit less of that and a little bit more of what gives your life meaning as a writer. So I did. I did travel around quite a bit, especially in my early career.
Yeah. Well, also through Straight Man, we get a glimpse at some of the essays English professors have to read, thanks to a character by the name of Leo.
Right.
intense and frustrated young man. Do you miss teaching?
Yeah, I do. I still continue to teach a little bit. I teach in a Master of Fine Arts program in North Carolina called the Warren Wilson program. And I'm on a schedule there where I teach every other year or so for a semester. It's a unique writing program that's aimed especially at older writers, people who have careers in other fields but who have always wanted to write and are looking to make a career change. They tend to be in their 30s and 40s, and I've had wonderful students there over the years who have. You know, they've been bankers and insurance agents and housewives and all sorts of people who come to the writing program a little bit later in life than your typical graduate student.
Yeah.
And so it's a program too that doesn't require people to quit their careers because we all come together for very intense periods of 10 days to 2 weeks, once in the summer and once in the winter. And then the writers on the faculty, who all live all over the place, return home with three or four students. They don't actually come with us, but they're with us for the rest of the term in terms of sending us their work and corresponding through through the mail. So I still do that kind of teaching, and I do the occasional visit, as I did at Colby this year with a friend of mine who was teaching a screenwriting course, and I went up and did a class there. And when I enter the classroom, I'm aware of just how much I'm giving up in terms of life with students, because that's the rewarding part of teaching, of course, is the actual teaching. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I don't miss the life at all. I don't miss the... As anybody who's read Straight Man knows that I haven't missed any English department meetings since departing that particular fold. But the teaching itself, I do miss, despite how time-consuming it was.
The characters of Straight Man are absolutely wonderful, although it makes me wonder how great an exaggeration are they? I mean, clearly they are exaggerated to great, wonderful...
Really? How?
Well, I guess they're not an exaggeration. It's really like that, huh?
Well, you know,
it's a documentary.
It depends upon your point of view. There's a very good friend of mine. A lot of these characters in this book are composites, of course, and you know, I've stolen a trait here and a line of dialogue there, and people have written me up and written to me afterwards and said, you know, I said that at one point, didn't I? And I've said, well, yeah, I mean, I might have taken that from you. But a friend of mine wrote me not long ago, a person that I thought of from time to time, along with one or two other dear friends, when I was constructing this character of Lucky Hank, William Henry Devereaux Jr., who is the protagonist of this book. And this friend of mine who called me up about another matter entirely said, you know, a friend of mine had read Straight Man and said that he thought it was one of the most hilarious books he'd read in a long time. And my friend Dan said, really, what'd you find funny about it? And that was a very dry, very droll line, of course. But to anybody who suffered it, it's perhaps not as funny as someone looking at it from the outside. You know, a lot of these characters, if I told absolute literal truth, and had not invented things and had not actually toned things down in some respect. That these characters might as well. There's one young character in Straight Man. I've actually forgotten his name because
Campbell Weimer.
Yes. And he's the character can be either a man or a woman whose principal function in the department is to correct other people's use of pronouns whenever. A person is referred to, we need to hire someone in 19th century American literature next year, and then in the next sentence says he should be. This character's function in the English department is to correct the pronoun usage and say, or she, he, or she. And every place I've been lately, there's been somebody in the department to remind everyone about the correct usage of their pronouns by saying, or she. So this particular character, of course, in the novel is immediately dubbed or she in the novel, and he's known as that throughout the rest of the book.
Or she. And feminist poets, they're on the faculty as well out there, like Gracie Dubois, which is
yeah, I'm not sure Gracie actually qualifies as a feminist.
Oh, okay.
She probably would view herself as a feminist, but she's far too concerned with her former life as a kind of English department femme fatale, gone slightly to seed, to qualify as a genuine feminist.
Right.
But yes, there are Gracies everywhere too.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you this question, but now it sort of seems maybe it's not such a good question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
Do your characters surprise you?
Inevitably.
Mm.
Invariably. I'm trying to think why you were reluctant to ask that question.
Well, if the characters are toned down, and mm-hmm. if you almost make it sound like there's less imagination here than I would mm-hmm. say has to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, you know, imagination. When people use the term, I've talked endlessly about this whole process of imagination with generations now of fiction writers, university and college students when it comes right down to it, I mean, that's what a course in fiction writing or poetry writing is. It's a course in the imagination about how it works and really what it is. And what most people think of as imagination is invention. And that is, of course, a large part of what imagination is. It's the ability to supply what isn't and never was in a fairly realistic setting. It's your ability to go beyond what you've experienced in this life and to add to it through the process of invention. What a lot of people don't realize, though, is that there are a lot of other parts to the literary imagination than invention. One of the, I think, the primary qualities of invention is deletion. To know what can be taken out in order to form a pattern that you can see clearly, that you wouldn't be able to see clearly if you just continued to add through accretion detail upon detail upon detail. I mean, what I've used in Straight Man probably comprises maybe one hundredth of what I know about the Academy. So part of imagination mm-hmm. is to know mm-hmm. the 99% of which you can cut out in order for what remains to form a kind of coherent mm-hmm. and meaningful pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the imagination, I think if you write stories about the Academy, and you've been part of the Academy for 20 or 25 years as I have, part of the real test is to know what you can leave out, what you don't really need. The shorter, more compact brushstrokes are very often better, I think, and one of the reasons why academic novels it's not a form that I like particularly well. I don't, as a rule, like academic novels. And one of the reasons I don't usually like them is that they are so often exercises in revenge, you know, getting even with colleagues past and present, and an inability on the author's part to weed out a lot of that stuff, a lot of these, you know, old wounds and scars and scabs that a certain kind of writer likes to pick over and you know, remember the cause of.
Mm-hmm.
I did my darndest to weed as much of that out as I could, and where I supplied imagination, that is in the sense of invention, was in looking kind of beneath the literal aspects of the life of an Orshi, or the life of a Phineas Coombe, or the life of even Hank Devereaux himself. Was to find the humanity, the fears, the desires, the stunted and lost dreams of people who had envisioned an entirely different life for themselves as academics than the ones that they're left, the ones that they find themselves with and living out.
Yeah, Lucky Hank is one of the good guys. He's the straight man who seems alone in seeing the absurdities of life at WCPU.
Yeah.
And those elements make him that makes him very sympathetic. How did that character begin to take shape in your imagination and in your How did you approach inventing him?
Well, Hank, it was an interesting. Hank developed over a period of many years. Many years ago, it's probably almost, gosh, it's got to be almost 20 years ago now. I was teaching at an institution which will remain nameless. I was walking along with a friend of mine who was I forget his exact title. It was a dean for academic affairs or chief administrator for academic affairs or something along those lines. And it was my first full-time job. And I was walking along with this fellow who had become kind of a friend. He had taken me under his wing, as he did with many young, recently hired faculty members. And we were walking along the campus, and he was talking about the fact that yet again, another year, another April had come, and he had a very simple thing that he wanted to do, and that was to tell all of his adjunct people who were not on a tenure track and who were much abused and these are the kind of people who teach three or four classes sometimes, or five or six classes at maybe three different academic institutions, you know, running their cars, which are often on their last legs, you know, back and forth between four or five different institutions in the same city. And my friend was saying how nice it would be to be able to tell these people, yes, you will get your section of freshman composition or your two sections of freshman composition next year. Yes, you can count on that. We will continue to abuse your good nature for another semester or two, and just tell them that they'll have their jobs next year. And yet every year it seemed that he wasn't able to do that because he couldn't get his budget. And we happened to be walking by the pond on campus, and the ducks were all wandering around, and he said to me, this friend of mine, he says, every year it's the same thing. I don't know what I could do other than to threaten to kill a duck a day until they give me my budget. Well, this was just kind of an offhanded remark that this character made, that this real person made to me about 20 years ago. And it burrowed under, and he was clearly using it as a metaphor, and it burrowed deep in a kind of literal way, as the way things tend to do in my mind. And you know, for 20 years, I've been thinking from time to time about writing a story about a man who would literally threaten to kill a duck a day until he got a budget. So that was probably the earliest seed for the story. But about 6 or 7 years ago, during the time that I was writing Nobody's Fool, I think. I got to a place in that story, I don't remember what it was now, but I'd reached some sort of stone wall or other. And when I do that with a book, I think I've run into some sort of a problem that I don't know the solution to, many times I'll take a break and just write a short story. Hmm. And another friend of mine at that time, we were out having a beer one night, and he made another metaphorical comment, which I took literally. He was a man who said, well, I said, you got to go already. It was a Friday afternoon. We'd only been out for about 45 minutes. And he said, yeah, I got to go run my son-in-law out of town. and he didn't elaborate further on it. And because he didn't, the remark stuck. And when I got to this point in Nobody's Fool where I'd run up against a kind of roadblock or something or other, I wrote a story about a man who has the job of running his son-in-law out of town. And he goes in the story, which took place in Connecticut. This guy goes to his daughter's house, and his daughter and his son-in-law have gotten into a spat that has resulted in her getting a black eye. He doesn't know at first whether his son-in-law has struck her or whether she's fallen or whatever, but he decides that he doesn't care what exactly happened. All he knows is he's going to get out of town, and he does. He runs his son-in-law out of town, sends him off to I forget where in the story. Well, you know, that story, I had written that story and published it about 5 years ago, and yet I knew at the time that I wrote it, I'd only barely just scratched the surface of this father who has to run a grown-up son-in-law out of town. So that story stayed fresh in my mind. And when I finished Nobody's Fool, I thought, let's go back and see Hank again and see what he's up to. And I decided that he was an academic and that he might threaten to kill a goose, and that he was not living anymore in Connecticut, but rather in Pennsylvania. And things began to come together.
Is it difficult writing humor? Do you find it something really, it's work, but you really enjoy it?
Students are always asking me, how do you make things funny?
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell them I've never made anything funny. It is funny, the way I look at things. I'm just reporting what I see. And that's a little bit of a glib answer, I suspect, but not entirely. Because, you know, over the years, as I've written, I think in my first novel, Mohawk, you know, I haven't read that book really since it was published, but I think that my sense of that book is that it was a book written when I was just beginning to have an inkling of the kind of writer that I might be. My earliest attempts at fiction writing were pretty humorless. And not successful attempts at seeing the world in a way that was very foreign to my nature, but I didn't know that yet. I came at fiction writing from an odd angle. I already had was very near to finishing a PhD in American literature. I was a pretty serious young man at that point, and I was trying to write. Very serious. I still think of my work as serious, but this was serious and humorless, I was attempting to see the world, I think, through somebody else's eyes, or a combination of writers' eyes that were not my eyes. And at some point, I began to realize that a comic writer's view of the world is every bit as true as a tragic writer's view of the world, and that comedy and tragedy are not mutually exclusive. Comedy and sadness are not mutually exclusive, and that there was just as much, certainly philosophical or theoretical justification for seeing the world as a very odd and funny place, as there is a seeing life as very, very serious and humorless business, which was what I was trying to do. Once it dawned on me that there was as much truth in comedy as in tragedy, and that seemed to fit my own artistic personality, I guess. It freed everything up. For me, it freed me to see the world in a way that was natural for me, that was temperamentally natural for me. I guess that's the word I was looking for. Seeing human beings in the midst of their sad folly is seeing them with a there but for the grace of God go I, or actually there go I, you know, sometimes, was a way of looking at the world that was suited artistically to my temperament.
Yeah. I know a woman who is a reporter, and she does a lot of political reporting, and I've seen her work, and she'll often chuckle while she's writing her stories. She's listening back to what people have said and talking about, you know, the strange twists that these stories take. And I think that kind of approach has helped make her a good reporter and has kept her reporting fresh over the years, because she sees the humanity in what she's reporting, and she's not out to grind an axe.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
She,
nor am I. Yeah. You know, I that's you know, it's an attempt to restore sanity, I suppose, or find sanity through insanity.
You know, there's a conversation that takes place in Straight Man between Hank and his mom, Hank's mother.
Yeah.
She criticizes him for the satirical pieces he writes for the local newspaper, which have a lot of personal information in them.
Right.
And she tells him over lunch, humor is a poor substitute for accuracy and a poorer proxy for truth.
Yeah.
How do you view what Hank's mother has to tell her son there? And how he takes it. He finds it hard to swallow.
Yeah, yeah. He parries that in some Hank-like way, as I recall. He parries that without actually taking issue with it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I suppose, what a humorist would do in that situation. Hank's mother, I think, believes that he has become glib, and that he has become the kind of man and the kind of writer that will do anything for a laugh. And I think that the danger in humor writing, I suppose, is the danger in any kind of art, and that is that once the artist knows what he or she does well, is that you begin to use it as a crutch, and you don't put the test of truth two things in quite as rigorous a way as you should. I'm thinking of humorous writers who will be attacked in that way from time to time. The person who will sacrifice a moment of truth for a good one-liner,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think that Hank's mother sees that in him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether it's true or not. I think that there is a certain way that Hank in Straight Man comes to realize that as an artist, he has not been working up to his full potential.
Yeah.
That as he has become tenured in all the various ways that you can become tenured, you can become tenured in a good marriage. Hank and his wife have. I mean, despite this week that he goes through where he suspects his wife is being unfaithful to him and is tempted to be unfaithful to her, I think they have a wonderful marriage.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that their marriage, as good as it is, has begun to feel tenured to him. And there are ways in which he's looking at it not quite as honestly as he probably should, without the kind of urgency. What Lily wants of him in their marriage is a little bit like what Hank's mother wants of him in terms of his work, to be a little bit more urgent, to be a little bit less glib, to see things in a humorous way is fine, but not at the expense of truth. And if you are a jokester in this world, there's nothing wrong with being the jokester as the fool is in Lear. The fool in Lear speaks more truth than any other character in the play. But his jokes are always done in the service of truth, not in obscuring a truth. And I think what Hank's mother raises, I think, an interesting philosophical point about what good humor really is. It doesn't bring you farther away from truth; it brings you closer to it. And I think she suspects that Hank is not doing that,
mm-hmm.
but Hank is also, in a sense, as the narrator of this novel, the teller of this tale. I think he, in a sense, proves his mother wrong. Because if he couldn't write the book, if he couldn't tell the story, if he were just as glib as his mother accuses him of being, then of course he wouldn't be capable of telling this tale.
Do you think the culture finds humor, irony, a high, and that often it's not as sharp as it should be? I mean, it's kind of an easy high.
In the sense of, you know, sitcom humor? Is that the,
yeah,
or just,
I mean,
humor in general?
I guess in terms of sitcom humor, at least that's a good example.
Yeah.
It seems very often you can find yourself involved in conversations where, you know, the object is to get off a good line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like we've all dropped into some sitcom world in some situations.
Yeah, it's the reason I can't watch sitcoms, is that it seems that the writers of them have no respect for their characters.
Mm.
They're willing to do anything with these characters in order and put them in any absurd situation that the character would never be in order to get off of, you know, a few good lines. But I find the same thing is true about script writing. You know, kind of really there's strained humor in all of these action movies that you see, and you hear Hollywood people talking about, oh yes, it's a very violent movie, but it's also very funny, they'll say.
Yeah.
And then you go to it, and you'll keep waiting for the funny parts, and then about halfway through, you begin to realize, you know, this last line that wasn't funny at all. I'll bet you that's what the studio people were thinking about when they said, "Oh, but it's funny also," and it's not funny. It's like that scene that horrible scene in True Lies where Jamie Lee Curtis does the strip show for the man that she does not know is her husband in the shadows.
Yeah.
That is so incredibly demeaning to both Jamie Lee Curtis's character, but also to the other character who's standing there putting his wife through this incredibly humiliating series of gestures just because he can. And it's not something the one character would do, and it's not something that the other character would do, and it's all supposed to be funny. And it's not funny at all. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
Except that I guess a lot of people thought it was funny. Or maybe they were just watching Jamie Lee Curtis take off her clothes and didn't really care much one way or the other whether it was funny or not. But that's the kind of humor that I object to.
Yeah. I found that pretty painful, too.
Yeah. I was just squirming in my seat. Just couldn't wait for that to be over.
How was it that you began writing screenplays? Was Nobody's Fool was
yeah,
the first?
Yeah, thank you. Also, I need to correct one thing you said early on, lest I take credit where credit is not due. I did script doctor work on Nobody's Fool. Robert Benton actually wrote the screenplay for that, and he's both a wonderful writer and now a friend. We've done two movies together, and we're thinking about doing a third. And I got involved in script writing through Benton because he had they were beginning to shoot the movie, and I got a call from Scott Rudin, who was producing the movie, and I got a call and asked if I would come down to the set and talk with Benton and Paul Newman about a few scenes that were not going well in rehearsal. And they were scenes that Benton had to invent because, you know, he had taken, you know, big sections of that book out, as he had to do, and in order to make bridges between the scenes that he had taken out and the scenes that remained, he'd had to construct some other scenes, and he was afraid that the scenes that he had written from the ground up sounded like Benton and the others sounded like Russo, and he wanted me to look at those scenes and see if I could rewrite some of the dialogue or rethink those scenes in a way that made it feel more of a piece and more make the dialogue sound more Russo-like, I guess. And so I went to the set and met with Benton, and we struck up an immediate friendship. I had admired his work, like The Late Show and Places in the Heart and Kramer versus Kramer and all those wonderful movies. And we struck up an immediate friendship, and he gave me a kind of quick, wonderful Yoda-like tutorial in screenwriting. When we finished that project, we immediately wanted to work again on something else, and that's how Twilight came about.
So you were the screen doctor for.
I was a script doctor on the first project, and then Benton and I co-wrote
Twilight.
Twilight, and now I'm working on the screenplay for for Straight Man on my own, and looking at another project or two also to. So where I used to be a part-time novelist and part-time teacher, I'm now. Or actually, I was a full-time novelist and full-time teacher, and now I'm kind of a full-time novelist and part-time screenwriter.
Yeah. Are you working on another novel?
I am 150 pages into a new book, which I am very anxious to return to, actually. I just sent in another draft of Straight Man to DreamWorks, which owns the rights to that novel. And very anxious to get back to this new novel that I'm working on.
Mm. Do you have a working title or a title?
I have a working title, the title is Nantucket, which is where the novel does not take place.
Do you find it difficult, you know, going back and forth from one kind of writing to the other?
It is sometimes difficult in terms of scheduling. Screenwriting tends to be more intense in shorter bursts of time, and people need things when they need things, and they heckle you till you get it, till you give it to them.
Yeah.
So it's difficult in that respect.
Yeah.
Novel writing is wonderful because you can do it at your own pace. I can write two or three pages a day and feel that I'm making real progress on it, know that there's no particular thing, no particular number of chapters that has to be done by any particular time, which also it's a much more difficult and demanding kind of writing where you don't have to feel quite as pressured by such things as deadlines.
Mm.
So it can be difficult in terms of time strategies. But since I think in a large part you use different intellectual muscles for novel writing than you do for screenwriting, but they're not incompatible.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't found it to be. It's certainly no more difficult. It's a lot less difficult, I think, than writing novels and teaching, for instance.
Who might be cast as Hank in Straight Man?
Oh Lord, I have no idea. I have no idea. And whoever they're talking about today won't be who they're talking about when the casting call finally goes out. I know last year for a time, all anybody could see was Kevin Kline, but that's when Kevin Kline had just come out with In and Out and The Ice Storm, and he was on everybody's mind and on everybody's lips for every role for anyone between the ages of 35 and 60. In any movie in Hollywood. So, of course, they were thinking about Kevin Kline then. I haven't heard his name lately. So there are a number of interesting actors out there, I think. I love the idea of William Hurt, actually. But I don't know whether that anybody else would share my enthusiasm for that or not. Kevin Costner, I think, would... If he's got apocalyptic movies out of his system now, he might be ready for the kind of small movie that he does so well.
Do you have a input into these kinds of issues?
No, no, not at all, not at all.
Well,
I have the same input on this movie as you do.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us and. I hope we can do it again when Nantucket's on the bookshelves.
Well, that would be very nice. I'd better get back to it then, shouldn't I?
Okay, take care.
Okay, Celeste, thank you very much for having me on the show. I enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Richard Russo has been our guest. Look for his book, Straight Man. That's his latest. It's now out in paperback from Vintage.